Hail, Kyone, announcer of the Colin McEnroe Show.
Hail, strange woman standing by the side of the road.
Hail.
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 All right, this is boring.
Hail, Kyone, host of the Kyone Wolf Show.
But I am no such thing. Say from whence you owe this strange intelligence, or why upon this blasted heath you stop my way with such prophetic greeting. Speak, I charge you.
Nay, I will not speak further unless you give me a wreath.
A holiday wreath with reindeer moss and false crab apples? Such things are not permitted without a gift of 120 polished rocks.
Then give me a bag of tote in the tartan of your clan and a badge that sticks to metal.
Sticks to metal? What sorcery is this? Wild woman, these things I cannot provide, but perhaps a mug from which your chapped mouth may sip warm drink.
Someday your mug will adorn a mug. But that will not come until I get a wreath and a tote bag and an eco-friendly umbrella. And now I go.
Whither is she vanished? Into the air, and what seemed corporal melted as breath into the wind. Would she had stayed? Did she speak the truth? Could I, my own show host? Could I drink from a flagon on which my likeness was emblazoned? There is only one way to know, but first I have to get off this blasted heath. And no GPS signal do I have. What witchery has shut down my 4G? While I solve that, pray spend this hour with the man who speaks in next chance, for he hath brains and opinion, though he keep pickerel in his pants. Colin McEnroe.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Harriet Jones, the voice of Harriet Jones, as our favorite weird sister here. All right, we're going to be talking about Macbeth today. We'd love to hear from you as we go along. I'll give you the phone number right now, although it's probably a waste of time because you haven't formulated an opinion yet. But it's 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Why are we talking about the Scottish play? Well, it's being staged right now at the Hartford Stage Company, and we're kind of in a Macbeth festival here, at least in these environs. Over at Trinity Cine Studio, they showed the Roman Polanski Macbeth for one night, and then they showed the National Theater production of Macbeth with Kenneth Branagh. Meanwhile, if you go into New York, they're seeing Sleep No More, which is not really Macbeth, although they kind of say it is. It's a strange deconstruction in which you chase actors or dancers or something around this ghostly haunted hotel over in Chelsea. Alan Cumming did a one-man version earlier this year on Broadway of Macbeth. So Macbeth is kind of everywhere. And why not? Let me tell you who we're going to talk to. David Scott Castan is the George M. Bodman Professor of English at Yale. Elizabeth Williamson is the Senior Dramaturg and Director of New Play Development at Hartford Stage. Jennifer Roberts is the Director of Education at Hartford Stage. See, that's another part of all this, is that one of the reasons I got interested in doing this show is that my son, who's currently taking classes at Capital Community College, is studying Macbeth as part of kind of a partnership between Hartford Stage and Capital Community College. And I started thinking, you know, what does it mean to somebody that age? What does it mean to somebody with those life experiences? And that's one of the other questions we'll be asking today. David Castan, I'm going to sort of start off with you. We should also say that we'll be talking to, it's a recorded interview, but Darko Tresnik, the artistic director of the Hartford Stage, who directed this Macbeth. You'll hear from him towards the end of this segment. But David Castan, you know, in a way, we see Macbeth all the time. I mean, to whatever extent we're confronted with any situation in which somebody does something out of character and appalling, and we ask ourselves, well, was he pulled along by circumstances, or were these qualities embedded in him from the get-go? I mean, America was recently watching with rapt fascination Breaking Bad. Macbeth is sort of the Scottish Breaking Bad. It's all about a man who's a chemistry teacher, and then suddenly he's a drug lord. He's a law-abiding, upstanding citizen, and suddenly he's a criminal. And so, David Castan, in some ways, when we watch Macbeth, is that one of the questions we ask, is how does he get from the, you know, pretty half-been decent, likable, well-esteemed guy at the beginning to the guy who's doing all these bad things?
That's great, Colin. I mean, Breaking Bad analogy had occurred to me, so you've stolen that. It does seem to me that is the remarkable thing about this play, is that, you know, of all of Shakespeare's major characters, the odd thing is Macbeth has the most fully articulate, fully developed moral intelligence. You know, Hamlet's always trying to figure out what's moral. Macbeth knows precisely what's moral, but then just gets tempted by sort of pushing those boundaries. I mean, it seems to me it's a different kind of logic in the sense that Macbeth, it seems to be, is just fascinated by discovering, you know, how far he can push the possibilities of the human. But he does begin, he's worthy Macbeth, he's brave Macbeth, valiant Macbeth, killing for the king. And once he kills the king, he becomes a monster. But the other question is, of course, what's actually the difference between killing for the king and killing the king? You know, there's sort of a whole set of very interesting moral problematics that the play sets in motion, you know, very much like Breaking Bad.
Is it also fair to say that as a scholar, as a literary interpreter of Macbeth, you kind of have the luxury of entertaining multiple possibilities? You can look at this play and read it a couple of different ways or explore different levels of meaning. When somebody like Darko Treznik stages it, ultimately he's got to make some kind of set of choices, right? He's got to make, most good directors are going to have to decide one way or another who this guy really is.
Right. All good directors have to make that decision. I think Darko is one of the great directors working in America right now. But it does seem that is exactly the biggest difference. An academic, a literary critic, a student has that luxury of exploring the full density of the possibilities of language. An actor has to decide. You know, there's a wonderful line in Macbeth where he talks the issue. But if we fail at that moment of trying to figure out, can they do this? When you could deliver that line in so many different ways, but an actor doesn't have the choice of saying one way and then coming back and doing it. But on the other hand, it might go like this. But a literary critic is always exploring that set of multiple possibilities that the language releases, where a director and actor has to commit.
As we go along here, particularly in our subsequent segments, we'll talk a little bit about whether it's fair or good or just inevitable, even though it's not fair or good, that we analogize from Macbeth to present-day circumstances, whether they're on the screen like Breaking Bad or in real life. But Elizabeth Williamson, listening to the conversation that I'm having with David, is this a conversation that you and the rest of the artistic staff of Hartford Stage sits around having too? Like, who is this guy? What is our take on this play? What is the Hartford Stage production going to be saying about who this guy is?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm in the lucky position of being, in effect, the scholar in the room. Though, unlike David, I'm much more of a generalist. My own background is in French theater. So one of the joys of working in my job at Hartford Stage is that I'm able to also spend time with Shakespeare. I think one of the things that I found the most interesting about exploring Macbeth with Matt Rausch, who's our wonderful Macbeth, was discovering how much, as David started to mention, Macbeth is kind of like Hamlet. He takes us into his confidence as he tries to make the decision. And he does go back and forth quite a bit. He knows that it's wrong to kill the king, and he's not sure whether he's going to do it or not. And it's Lady Macbeth who early on identifies the quote-unquote problem in his character, which is that he has the ambition to become king, but not, as she calls it, the illness that should attend it. And so she considers her role in some way to be pushing him on to do the bad thing he has to do in her eyes to gain the goal of becoming king.
But David Caston, one of the fundamental questions is, how hard a push does that have to be? And if you look at the body count, at a certain point, you know, I mean, you can't really trace it back to Lady Macbeth anymore. She doesn't tell him to kill Banquo. He starts making some pretty ruthless decisions on his own, right?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about Macbeth is there's a trajectory, a kind of coarsening of his moral intelligence. I mean, he begins very certain what's right and what he's intrigued by. I mean, Elizabeth's right. I mean, ambition drives this, but it's not ambition precisely to be king. You know, he never has a moment of saying, God, wouldn't it be wonderful to be king? You could eat all the ice cream you wanted. I mean, he's never focusing on what that means. What he's fascinated by is that boundary between the human and the either superhuman or bestial. And, you know, for me, always one of the key lines is that there's a moment when he talks about, so stars, hide your fires, let not light see my dark and deep desires. But then he says, but yet let that be, which the eye fears when it is done to see. I'm going to do it anyway. And what he does at the beginning of the play, if you think about the logic of the murders, I mean, he murders Duncan to bring about the prophecy, to confirm the prophecy of the witches. And when he murders Banquo, it's actually to prevent the prophecy of the witches, because they had prophesied that Banquo's line would be, he would be father to a race of kings. And then when he kills Macduff's wife and family, it has nothing to do with anything. It's just this gradual coarsening and you just see the what put him on this way. And so the Breaking Bad analogy isn't so bad, I have to say.
You know, Jennifer Roberts, as you begin to sort of work with the people who are going to teach this, are these the kinds of conversations you're having? I'm sort of wondering, I mean, my son and I have been talking a lot about Macbeth lately, but I'm wondering, what kinds of things educationally do you explore as you talk about ways to present this play in the classroom?
Well, I think we have to start with the language. Depending on the student's level, we have a lot of high school students coming. We also have college students coming. And really, I think at first glance, the language can seem to some inaccessible. And the best part for me watching students watch the show is watching students understand that they can get this. They can understand it. They can follow the story. And so when we go into a classroom, we really start with the language itself, giving them tools to understand it, to really see that just because it was written over 400 years ago doesn't mean that it doesn't speak to us today. And then we start to kind of make sure that they understand who the characters are, what is the basic story, and then they see the play, and then we can really jump into these themes of ambition and destiny and fate, which are these amazing conversations that we've had with students over the past few weeks.
All right. As we go along here, I want to talk to you and to everybody here about how it does speak to us today. Before we do that, let's hear from the man who's directing the show, who has directed the show that's running at Hartford Stage right now. Here's a conversation I had a few days ago with Darko Tresnik. So one of the people deeply engrossed in Macbeth right now is Darko Tresnik. He is the artistic director of the Hartford Stage Company. Macbeth is running there in repertory. It's alternating with a French comedy, same actors, through November 10th. But you got about four more weeks to see it. First of all, welcome to the show. And second of all, is this your first Macbeth, or do you have a few of them under your belt already?
No, this is my first production of Macbeth. I've directed 21 productions of Shakespeare plays, and I figured I was ready. I think it's not a starter Shakespeare play. I think people often fall into that trap, but I wanted to really be ready, and I think I wanted to be a little bit older before directing it.
And why is that? Explain a little bit more of your thinking.
Well, I think that part of what the play is about is that thematically, I think, for me personally, I think it's about certain things that elude us in life and about still wanting those things and about reaching for them. So for me, I didn't want to disassociate myself from that aspect of the play, you know, so I felt like I should be in my 40s before I direct it. Because I think all of us are ambitious, you know, and the big question in the play is, what would you do to achieve your goals? So the harder thing is, because of the horrors of the play, you could disassociate yourself completely, but I think the harder thing is, you know, to ask that question about lines that are crossed. So that's why I felt like I needed to be older. But the other thing about it is, technically, it's such an imaginative play, but I think it's full of traps. And I just felt like I wanted to be in a really mature place as an artist before directing it.
You know, it's interesting, too, because Macbeth obviously does not want this opportunity to elude him. On the other hand, we don't really get the feeling, at least I don't get the feeling, that he's getting older and opportunities have passed him by or anything like that. I think it's almost more the sense that someone, the minute this is suggested to him as a possibility, he wants to make it a reality.
Well, I think that that's the thing, that those ambitions are already inside of him. And I think the witches stand for anything in life. You know, I think that they're symbols for anything that happens in our lives that touches us in that moment of utmost vulnerability. So I think he's, at that point, he is flying high when he encounters the witches. He's flying high. He's confident from having won all of these battles. Everybody's praising him. And they come in and tell him, hey, you deserve this, you know, and that's the downfall. But I think those ambitions, those things are already inside of him and his wife. And she talks at one point, about wanting to escape from the ignorant present, which is a line that was very important to me. The sense that there is, in fact, something that they want to escape from.
And it seems also as though, I mean, this play is about the mysteries of ambition and also about the mysteries of what goes on between couples.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
How do you see this particular couple? How I mean, obviously, there are just things that are written into the text that you can't miss. But as you explore that relationship as a director, what is it to you?
You know, I think that they're I think they're frightfully connected to each other at the beginning of the play. I mean, the connection is amazing, and that has been, it's not an original thing to say. Mm-hmm. Everybody's pointed it out that it's one of the most connected couples in all of Shakespeare, you know, because in general he did not have charitable views of marriage mm-hmm. in his plays, probably because his own marriage was not so great. But I think that at one point he leaves her behind. And I think, you know, to me, we've talked about this a lot, is he's got the greatest visual imagination of any tragic hero in Shakespeare. Macbeth does, you know. It's a very visual imagination. He conjures all of these things. Whereas with her, I think she's a study in concentration. I think she sees the murder of Duncan as an essential act for them to get to where they deserve to be. Mm-hmm. And once Duncan is killed, actually, I think she could go on very peacefully. I think she could live with what they've done. There's no question in my mind about that. The problem is she does not realize the effect that this is going to have on her husband, because his imagination spirals out of control, gets increasingly paranoid, and at one point he leaves her behind. So I think, you know, what's frightening about her is her absolute concentration and dedication to this one act. But then everything after that, the murder of Banquo, Macduff's family, she's actually, to the extent that Shakespeare gives us the text, she's actually horrified that he's going to keep doing those things. So I think that that's the difference between a very focused, single-minded woman and between a man who, once he commits one horror, he can't stop himself.
Do you find yourself wanting to find something sympathetic about her? You know, in some ways, I think you have to deal with the weight of the fact that she has turned into this archetype, and she is a label that's applied to any woman who has any kind of ambition, particularly if the woman is part of a couple. So whether it's Hillary Clinton or somebody else, the Lady Macbeth thing just gets smacked on anybody, whether it fits or not.
The key really is, part of the key is in the casting, you know what I mean? And what I love about both Matt and about Kate Forbes as Lady M is that essentially she has a trustworthy presence. Mm-hmm. That's what's frightening about the play, you know what I mean? In the beginning, he is a good soldier. In the beginning, she's a good hostess. Nobody casts doubt on these two. And that is something that I've seen missing, you know, in many productions that I've seen, that essentially the society seems to view them as trustworthy people. And the other thing is, you know, in the pecking order, he is not as high in the beginning of the play as other thanes. So often they're presented as a very glamorous couple from the outset, but I don't think that that's actually what Shakespeare wrote. So that in the beginning, socially and where they fit in this world, they're just two very good citizens. And I think there's something very, very middle class about them if they live today.
And if they're good citizens, it raises the question of where does the spell, so to speak, come from? Is it always inside them, or is it, and once again, one's tempted to analogize in all kinds of ways to the president and various, almost any political figure you've ever seen rise through the ranks. It seems as though one step up just creates a hunger for the next step up. Is it a play ultimately about that sort of pull that you're like hooked like a trout being reeled further and further up the ladder, whether you understand why you want it or not?
Yeah. I think that is part of it. And that, I think for me, it's about consequences of a single immoral choice. Mm-hmm. That once they commit that thing, that there is no going back, that the horrors keep multiplying. So it's really interesting, because I know that you're focusing in this interview on education, but I think that's what's interesting about students seeing the play. I'm very proud of the fact, we're presenting the play to high school students and to college students. We're doing school matinees, and we're not changing anything. Mm-hmm. We're not changing, not a single act of violence. We're not tempering it, because ultimately I think it's a very moral play, because it's an in-depth look at the consequences of wrong choices, as opposed to so much of what they see, you know, in film or television.
Well, listen, I know you've got other things to do. You're supposed to be back in New York City soon. So thanks for carving out a little bit of time for us today. It's great to talk
to you.
That's Darko Treznik. He is the artistic director of the Hartford Stage Company. He's the director of this production of Macbeth, which is running through November 10th. Macbeth wants power, because he and his wife grab all that power. We're talking about Macbeth. Welcome back to the show. We'd love to hear from you as we go along here. With us in studio, Elizabeth Williamson and Jennifer Roberts, both from the Hartford Stage. David Scott Kasten is a professor of English at Yale University. He's down the line in the studios of Yale University. We'd love to hear from you at 860-275-7266 as we go along. So, David Kasten, you know, there's sort of a way of looking at these things, sometimes called a presentist way of looking at these things, and often followed by the word fallacy. But I'm sort of a presentist, I think, particularly when I look at Macbeth. And let me sketch out a scenario for you, and then you can tell me why I'm nuts. But so there's this idealistic constitutional law professor who's got an incredible able to articulate a wonderful vision for the world. He gets elected president. 5 years later, he's overseeing a government that does extrajudicial executions of American citizens on foreign soil using drones. There are sometimes collateral damage, as they say, killings of children by these drones. He has a tremendous amount of time shutting down the prison that is the symbol of everything that he ever objected to. He's overseeing a system of surveillance, which is spying on ordinary American citizens, and overseeing a Justice Department, which is constantly prosecuting members of the press who try to report on the surveillance system, more prosecutions than all of his predecessors combined. And you look at this man and you think, I thought I knew who he was in 2008. This seems very different from that. How did he get there? Was I fooled in 2008 about who he was? Did he have some of these qualities embedded in him? Or are there just circumstances which warp the character of an otherwise noble person into doing things that seem almost impossible and irreconcilable with who he was in the past? I watch Macbeth now and I think about that. So am I crazy? Well, I may be crazy, nope. Actually.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that. Yeah. But it does seem to me you're right. And I think theater makes all of us presentists. I mean, if it works, and it worked that way in Shakespeare's time too. Elizabeth, mm-hmm. Queen Elizabeth, when she was on the throne, when Richard II was both played, but also became a play that was played for the Earl of Essex in 1601, there was a sort of aborted rebellion against the Queen, and he paid Shakespeare's company to perform Richard II in the streets of London as a kind of preparation for the rebellion, which failed spectacularly. And there's a kind of recognition that Shakespeare's plays always have contemporary relevance. And Elizabeth, at one point, not thinking about that particularly, but just recognizing her susceptibility to the appeals of some charismatic aristocrat. She was going through the Tower and being shown the libraries of various earlier kings, and William Lombard shows her Richard II's library, and she turns to him and says, I am Richard II, know ye not that? I mean, she certainly read the past as predictive in some way of the future. And Macbeth, for an Elizabethan or an early Jacobean audience, would have been very much a sort of presentist play. On the throne now is James I of England, James VI of Scotland, and all of this, the way in which the play is articulating the relationships between England and Scotland at the moment when England is trying to confront the fact that now the King of England is in fact a Scot. Remember, they're different countries at that moment. King James is the king of two countries, not ruling over one country. And this play would have inevitably been read in some way as a presentist play. And I think that's the history of our relationship with Shakespeare. We sort of do what we can to stay in contact with him. And this is just another example of it. Your rather brilliant reading of the moment is something that seems to me has happened at every moment in the history of every historical confrontation with those Shakespearean plays, the kind of wonderful density of them that sort of allows them endlessly to absorb new histories that, of course, they never could have intended. But I do think that anyone in that audience would have certainly read this as a very much a presentist play, somehow about this desire for the union and this uncertainty about the relationship of England and Scotland and, its own complicated succession story that it tells, right? I mean, one level, it's a perfectly orthodox play. I was thinking of something Darko said in the interview with him, and he says that he's not just showing us wrong choices, which I think is really crucial to this, because on the one hand, you could read it, utterly as an orthodox play. Someone does something bad, and finally the forces of good overwhelm the forces of evil, to Quincy calls Macbeth an awful parenthesis in eternity. But what's weird about the play is, you know, Macbeth continues to fascinate us. It's not, even though we see he's wrong, you know, we're always seduced in some way. We're interested in him in a way we're never quite interested in the moral characters whose judgments seem flawed. And this odd play sort of complicates its own morality, its own politics, and that complication is the space that I think allows, you know, subsequent ages to find a place where they can engage with it.
Elizabeth, I saw your finger go up at one point. I'll have to interrupt you in about a minute for a little fundraising break. But yeah, what did you want to say?
I was just going to jump in and say, of course, for the politics of the time, there's a strong argument to be made that the king, King James I, when Macbeth was put on, assumed that all terrorists, as we would call them, were associated with witches. So there's, I mean, I don't know if, David, you want to talk at all about the gunpowder plot, but a challenge for any modern production is how to do the play without getting too mired in the politics of the time. And I think for us, choosing to set it in the 11th century, we're also trying to leave open the option for the audience to have the response that you have, Colin, without making the production about that.
All right. When we get back, we're going to talk to Jennifer Roberts a little bit more about, once again, how that gets taught, how you bring students who are stuck in their own real life mindsets into the world of Macbeth. We're going to take a quick break here. Do consider, by the way, during this break, ordering the brand new Colin McEnroe Show mug, alluded to in the introduction today. They'll tell you how to do it, and it's with a gift of $60 or polished stones or more.
The king is coming to visit, and then I have to murder him. I need some hostessing tips. What does Martha Stewart have to say about this? Let's just jump to the index. Murdering the king, murdering the king, murder. Maybe it's king, murdering of. Got it. Okay, set the table well in advance and plan a meal that won't keep you pinned down in the kitchen when your guests arrive. That way you can really concentrate on murdering the king. Keep your daggers stored in plastic tubs in the basement where you can find them without a fuss. See, this is so helpful. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our intern, Tess McAaronson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sir Laurence Olivier. On tomorrow's show, let's go to the movies with David Edelstein and A.O. Scott. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, we've got an exciting movie show for you tomorrow, but we've got an exciting Shakespeare show for you right now. We're talking about Macbeth, which is being staged at the Hartford Stage Company. A lot of other interesting productions have floated around both on the screen and on the stage over the last year. One of the things we want to talk a little bit about is how this is being taught. I mentioned at the top of the show that at Capital Community College, it's a big part of the curriculum. Capital Community College is right down the street from Hartford Stage Company. So Jennifer Roberts, first of all, Jennifer Roberts is Director of Education at Hartford Stage. A couple of things here. First thing, we're talking about this a little bit during the break, but both Darko and I know other people from Hartford Stage have talked about the quandary that Hartford Stage had about leaving all of the violence in the play, particularly if it was going to be seen by a lot of student audiences at student matinees, and these Capital students, I can think, can go for $5 and see the play. I would have thought that would have been a layup. I mean, young people tend to really like violence. They see a lot of violence on video games and in the movies they watch. Why was there any question about that?
Well, it's a question that's come up with lots of grown-ups that have asked about students coming to see the show since then. And, you know, I sat in tech with Darko, and we had a big discussion about the moments that there were questions about some moments of sexual violence particularly. And as Darko said, we're really proud and stand by our decision not to take that out. I think that Elizabeth just said that Darko made the decision to set this in medieval Scotland, which is a very harsh, brutal environment, and one that can seem very different from ours, and then one that can seem not so different when you think about sort of the acceptance of violence as part of the culture. And we accept violence sort of in on TV and in movies, and so we can say to teachers or parents that the violence that these students are seeing on the stage is not really that different than anything they'll see on TV or in a movie or on a video game. But what's interesting to watch is what happens when the filter of the screen is removed and they're seeing it live. And that's led to some good conversations with students just about violence. And then again, as Darko said, the consequences of that violence.
I have some more questions to ask you about how it's being taught in some of these places, especially at community college. Before we do that, let me grab a call from David in Lakeville, who may have a question or comment for David in New Haven. Let's see. Hi, David.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Just was wondering what the panel would think of the idea that the idiot in the famous, you know, this tale told by an idiot speech is his own mind. So what he's referring to is his own mind.
Oh, and I think he may have been overcome and hung up. Well, maybe a way to go from there is, we can sort of speak to that question, but David Kasten, so much of the language in this play is language that's actually familiar to us. And sometimes encountering a play like this, I'm surprised by or newly reminded maybe of what's in it that I'd forgotten, the be-all and end-all. I assume that's the first time that phrase has ever been used, the milk of human kindness. I assume the same about that. And certainly we know that the sound and the fury, the tale was told by an idiot at the end, these are, you know, things that turned into, well, obviously fell into the hands of Faulkner much later. The language in this play is sort of iconic and embedded for us.
I think it's the great fact of Shakespeare that people have observed for a long time. I mean, there's a character in Mansfield Park where, you know, Robert says, "We all speak Shakespeare." And it's true. I mean, that Shakespeare's language has sort of penetrated ours. That is the remarkable quality, the number of titles that come from Shakespeare's Brave New World, North by Northwest, Where Eagles Dare. You know, you can just multiply them endlessly. But it always seems to me the other side of that is Shakespeare's obviously a wonderful wordsmith, that's clear. But it seems to me what he really is, just one of the great listeners of all times. I mean, we have a tendency to sort of give him credit for not only inventing phrases, which certainly he has, but inventing words, which I suspect actually just he didn't invent at all. He was the first person in whose works they appeared in print. I think he just listened incredibly intensely. But his language is our language, you know, our moral and psychological and political vocabularies in some way come from Shakespeare. He's so deeply embedded in our consciousness at that level of language, which is really remarkable. There's no English writer or anything like it. I mean, the closest is probably the language of the King James Bible.
Absolutely. So I want to go back to you, Jennifer Roberts, for just a second here. I know this is being taught at Capital Community College. You surprised me during the break by saying it's not just being taught in literature classes. It's being taught by all kinds of people there in all kinds of settings.
Right.
Tell me about that.
This is the second year of our One Play partnership with Capital. And the idea of One Play is that the whole college comes together around one play each semester. So not just theater classes, English classes, classes in the humanities that, you know, you would imagine would read and see this play, but also management and marketing and architecture and math.
Math? What can you do with this in math?
Well,
game theory?
Well, I did.
It's more management.
I just talked to that professor. I asked that question. And, you know, she said that it's really about having them participate in the culture of Hartford. And so I think that some of the faculty are really integrating it into their classes to the extent that they can. Some of them are really encouraging their students just to participate and become part of the community, the cultural community of Hartford. And then there's sort of a hybrid of, so in management, talking about what makes a well-rounded manager, what makes a well-rounded person, having all of these experiences and understanding the community.
And sometimes the collaborative model isn't as good as it should be.
Right.
There's a lot of bad management decisions that are made there.
Right.
So it could be more of a negative model than a positive. That's really amazing, though. I had no idea about that. That's such a great concept, the idea that it would just seep into every nook and cranny. Hey, before we run out of time, we haven't really talked that much about Lady Macbeth. I'm going to start with you, Elizabeth Williamson. I mean, you know, here I think any of David Kasten's reservations about presentism are very warranted. This is now, she is such an icon that she's slapped on to virtually any woman who aspires to any kind of power, certainly any kind of woman who is linked to a powerful man but also has a visible presence. Hillary Clinton probably is the name that jumps to mind as someone on whom this is just arbitrarily slapped. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, first of all, We can get to the presentism about it. But, I mean, who is Lady Macbeth to you and to this production?
It's interesting. As we went through rehearsals, and we had a longer rehearsal process than usual because we were also rehearsing La Dispute at the same time. And so Kate was going back and forth from playing Lady Macbeth to playing Charisse in La Dispute. The more we worked on it, the more she seemed to keep throwing away ideas and saying, I just have to play the text. I just have to play the text in every moment. If I'm trying to play something beyond it, I'm getting in trouble. I mean, there are a few things we know about her. We know that they had children and they do not. We know that her life would have revolved to quite a strong degree around Macbeth in the 11th century. That she's running the castle when he's gone, and that they're very close for the first half of the play, and then we don't see them together again, and then we see her mad, and then we know she kills herself. So the strongest choice in the play, which I don't want to talk about too much on air because I don't want to spoil it, is the choice that she, Matt Rausch, and our director, Darka Trezniak, made at the end of part one, which is a huge jump, I think. It's got some basis in the text. That explains to us why we never see them together again. So that's sort of where I think we make the biggest choice with Lady Macbeth, that something really sours in their relationship, and he turns on her in our production.
David Castan, obviously Shakespeare is functioning in the Elizabethan era, so strong women aren't that big news in some ways. But is Lady Macbeth big news in literature, in drama at that moment, a character like this?
Well, I mean, it seems to me, there's something really fascinating about this. I mean, one way Darko sort of hinted at that in the interview you did with him. But, you know, one way, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, sort of the best marriage in any Shakespearean play. They, you know, they actually do something together. You know, unfortunately, what they do is murder a king. But, you know, they could have probably found a better activity to work together on. But what's interesting in that early part, whenever he's strong, she's weak. And whenever she's strong, he's weak. I mean, they're a perfectly compatible couple. And I guess I would put a slightly different spin on what Elizabeth just said. What interests me is Macbeth needs her at the beginning. He says, I lack a spur, I want a spur. And then there's the stage direction, enter Lady Macbeth, and he gets the spur to, you know, focus his ambition. And they actually need one another to commit the murder. And then it seems to me that what she's done to him, the way in which she gears him up to commit this act, is a kind of sexual taunting that's very interesting to watch. And she educates him in a sort of virulent notion of masculinity that ultimately demands her exclusion. And so the first murder they do together, and then when he decides that he has to murder Banquo and hopefully Fleance, which doesn't succeed in doing, he sort of pats her on the head and says, you know, be innocent of the knowledge, dearest Chuck. And it's the very thing she's educated him to do, to be a certain kind of man in this, you know, really defective notion of masculinity that defines manhood as the ability to take what you want. It absolutely demands her exclusion until at the end, as Elizabeth said, you know, she goes mad, she commits suicide, and the last thing you hear is the cry of women, you know, that she's pushed into this world of women and denied the access to the world of men that she functioned in, you know, so powerfully and effectively at the beginning. And I think, you know, Shakespeare is interested in relationships between men and women in a way that sort of nobody else at that time was. You know, I always say he was the first person to realize that smart women are sexy, which really was a great kind of insight. And he's fascinated. I think Darko suggested that he's not good on marriage, but I think that's not quite true. I mean, there are all these hints of the way he imagines the relationship of men and women. In Sonnet 125, he talks about being in mutual render. I think he imagines the possibility of mutuality, but realizes how hard it is to achieve. And, you know, this play is a particularly interesting example of that current.
It does seem that he's constantly experimenting both in the tragedies and the comedies with the whole question of sex roles and switching sex roles. And Lady Macbeth spells it right out. She says that she wishes she could unsex herself, that she could be the man, and she could do all these things that she agrees are basically the province of men.
Yep. I think that's right. And you have all these women in the comedies particularly. I mean, the logic of the comedies is always, you know, smart women educating plausible men, but need a kind of education to play the romantic role that the women imagine. But this is the kind of counter argument to that.
Well, I'm fascinated by what you're doing at Capital Community College, Jennifer Roberts. And it now, obviously, counseling classes, psychology classes, feminist study classes, it's all kicking in, right?
Right, yeah. I think the schedule, this happened at the really beginning of the school year. And so everyone kind of had to jump in really fast to a really complex piece of literature. And so Hartford Stage ran a program called Critical Eye, which is a professional development program we do with faculty. We bring in scholars. We sometimes bring in members of the artistic team to really give a context and to give ideas for just getting up on your feet and teaching this in a class. And so we did that early at the end of August. And then I think people started reading it. There are a couple Capital Community College students always get $10 tickets to our shows. But there are two or three particular nights that are one play nights where they get $5 tickets. So the idea is really trying to get a lot of people to see this all at once so that there can be discussions before and after, not only in the classrooms, but in a whole college-wide forum.
It's a great concept. We're going to have to stop there. Thanks so much to David Scott Kasten. He is a George M. Bodman Professor of English at Yale. Elizabeth Williamson, senior dramaturg at Hartford Stage. Jennifer Roberts, Director of Education. You heard from Darko Treznik earlier. We'll be back tomorrow with movies. A.O. Scott and David Edelstein, America's two greatest living film critics, will join me and Sam Hatch.
I am Kion McWolf, and at this time you will hear the voices of jesters who will plead your shekels to henceforth support this station. Shakespeare's language is best left to the professionals.